Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Lowell Nelson interrupting a recording of my show last week with a live show this week. Today is August 22nd, Tuesday, August 22nd, 2003, and you are listening to Lowell Nelson here on the path to state and local sovereignty. So today I have a vignette of my life on the Box End Ranch where I grew up. I have an article by Mike Meharry posted at the10thamendmentcenter.com about the preamble of the Constitution, and I have three guests in studio today eager to discuss important aspects of the election process in our counties. You are listening to KTalk Media, KBJA, 1640 AM, broadcasting from Kimber Academy in Linden, Utah. We are grateful to the Kimber Academy and their willingness to accommodate KTalk Media. Kimber Academy is a K-12 school aiming to serve God, family, and country, where teachers guide students toward faith and morality through engaging curriculum, and where every parent's voice is heard. To schedule your tour, visit kimberschool.com. That's kimberschool.com. Today is Tuesday, August 22nd, in the year of our Lord, 2023. And now, a vignette of my life on the Box End Ranch, where I grew up, north of Salmon, Idaho. Last time I was here, I think I told you about a game we played called 500. Well, today, I'm going to describe a game called Workup, which we played with softball. You know, I really don't see a lot of people playing that game today, although I find it hard to believe that it has disappeared entirely. Workup was really popular when I was in school because any number of people can play it, and ideally, of course, you would have maybe a dozen people playing it, but as few as two people could play this game, Workup. You need at least one person batting and at least one person fielding. The next couple of players are fielders. And if you have a fifth person, he is the second batter. And the next three players are fielders and so on. And the pitcher pitches the ball and the batter hits the ball and races for first base. And if the batter is thrown out, then he just grabs his glove and becomes a fielder, and the pitcher becomes a batter, and the first fielder becomes the pitcher, and so on. Now, if you have a dozen people, then all of the usual positions on the softball field can be filled, although you really don't need a catcher because any of the batters can toss the ball back to the pitcher. So when a batter is thrown out, he moves to right field. The right fielder moves to center fielder moves to left field moves to third base, third to second, shortstop moves to second base, and the second baseman moves to first baseman moves to pitcher, the pitcher moves to batter, right? So this movement around the softball diamond gives this game its name, workup. That's why we call it workup, and pretty much all the rest of the rules of softball are followed, and you just have a lot of fun playing this game. You get to pitch, you get to bat, you get to field the ball, and of course the better hitter you are, the longer you stay up to bat. And so that's kind of nice. If you're a good hitter, then you love workup because you're just batting all the time. Well, and that concludes my Ranch Life vignette for today. I hope you enjoy hearing these vignettes of my life on the ranch as much as I enjoy telling them, trying to remember some of our past, right? That's what we want to do, is have a firm grip on history. I value these memories. I hope that they will inspire in all of us a deeper appreciation for this beautiful land on which we live and a greater desire to live a self-reliant life in touch with God's green earth. I also value the liberty that is our birthright in this land. I am forever grateful for the Declaration of Independence, for the Constitution, for our understanding of the proper role of government. Adhering to the Constitution is vital to our federated republic. However, most of us do not adhere to it because we do not understand it. And so we don't push our public servants to adhere to it. And that, folks, must change. We have to understand it so that we can push are public servants. To adhere to it. And so that's why I like to talk about it, a little principle of the Constitution or principle of the proper role of government, every Tuesday morning on this show, which we archive at soundcloud.com/ktalkmedia, where you can listen to it or any previous shows on demand. And I provide a link to it on my Facebook page, which is also where you can share your insights, make suggestions, ask questions, and find links to the articles we discuss. Now, the purpose of this show is to help restore the sovereignty of the several states or of the people of the several states. When I talk about state sovereignty, what I'm really talking about is the sovereignty of the people domiciled in those states. And we can best do that if we nullify any legislative act of Congress, any executive order of the president, any judicial opinion of a federal judge, and any bureaucratic regulation of the general government that exceeds the bounds of that sacred compact, the Constitution for the United States. Now, posted at the 10thAmendmentCenter.com is an article by Mike Meharry entitled, "The Preamble is the Least Important Part of the Constitution." Now, most people know the preamble. It's poetic. It is lofty, inspiring. And most people think it authorizes all kinds of federal power, but this is not correct. The preamble doesn't actually do anything, and that's because a preamble doesn't grant, delegate, or restrict any government power. Black's Law Dictionary describes preamble as follows: a clause at the beginning of a constitution or statute explanatory of the reasons for its enactment and the objects sought to be accomplished. End of quote. So the purpose of a preamble is to provide context, really, for the rest of the document. It helps us understand the purpose or the why of the Constitution. Now, you all know the preamble. It goes somewhat like this, quote, "to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity." Well, this is poetic. It's lofty, but it does not confer any authority to the government at all. Now, most Americans mistakenly believe that the preamble empowers the general government to take any action necessary to achieve the stated purpose, but that just results in myriad unconstitutional actions. The actual grants of authority are enumerated in the Articles of the Constitution that follow the preamble. For example, Article 1, Section 8 lists the powers of the legislative branch of government. Article 2 delegates specific powers to the president. Article 3 establishes the authority of the judiciary, and so forth. Without the delegation of powers that follow, the preamble is nothing but a poetic list of objectives that with no mechanism to carry them into effect. So let's remember, ladies and gentlemen, that the states granted no authority to the general government in the preamble. And that concludes my thought about the Constitution this morning. So let me just turn it back to a little bit of music here while we wait, and we'll be right back with our guests right here on the path to state and local sovereignty. Thank you. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're just about ready here to launch this segment of our show. Pretty excited to have these guests in studio here with me today. Let me go ahead and introduce Lou. You have heard from Lou before. Lou Moore was the national campaign manager for the Ron Paul for President campaign back in 2007 and 2008, and that's when I became acquainted with Lou. Both of us are very keen, interested on working on election integrity here in the state of Utah. And so it is my pleasure to welcome Lou to the Path to State and Local Sovereignty this morning, and I'll invite him to introduce these two gentlemen from Salt Lake County.
Well, thanks, Lowell. Glad to be here today.
So today we have Roy Pescadlo and Steve Aist, and they're focusing on an issue that people have not been talking about enough, even within election integrity circles, which is the question of certifying the election, particularly certifying an election that's conducted in a black box, where the people certifying really cannot have the same level of scrutiny over an election as they did years and years ago. So, Roy, Steve, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're really glad to have you. If you move the mic a little bit, sorry you're sharing that mic there. But so first question is, election certification matters. That's what you guys are saying. So what are your goals? Why are you doing this?
Well, currently we have a rubber stamp process, and that's about it. Our board of canvassers, they're the ones that really, it's the county commissioners and county council members that act as the board of canvassers are supposed to thoroughly look at our elections and make a determination on whether they're accurate or not, and verify them. And they're not given the access or the information to the information that they need to thoroughly make a good decision about that.
So how did you guys get together, and what made you decide to take on this part of the whole election system that we're all very concerned about?
Well, I started getting involved in it after the 2020 election, and started looking into states like Georgia, Michigan, Wisconsin, et cetera, and then saw the pattern of behavior in those states and said, that can't happen here. Started looking inward.
This is Utah, after all.
This is Utah, after all. Exactly. That's exactly what I thought. It was Utah, after all.
Yeah.
Got access to the data and started looking in Salt Lake County, then Utah County, and so on. And I saw the same patterns that I saw in Pennsylvania and other states. And then I started to meet Steve at the same time because he was focused on that as well. And he was running for House District 41. I was working as a GOP ledge chair, and so ended up meeting Steve as a candidate, and we got talking on this, and that's how we started working on it.
So besides being hands-on grassroots activists, which in my opinion is the highest qualification many times for any of these things, what makes you feel like you're qualified to get into this issue with these fine elected officials and experts that I'm sure you've been talking to?
Well, Roy and I actually had a discussion about that. What does qualify us? And the biggest qualifier is actually that we're patriots, that we care about what happens.
Amen to that, brother.
Yeah, not only in the state of Utah, but in the larger scope of things, the country. That's our biggest qualification. And the fact that we're willing to get involved, and we need more people like us, regardless of their background, regardless of their education level, just to get involved and let their voice be heard. And I mean, we could answer that a lot of different ways, but that's our qualification.
Oh, that's awesome.
And the other thing I would say is the election process, you know, is really overcomplicated, and I think it's done so intentionally to make it seem inaccessible to the average human being. And really, if you spend some time in it and you have even a GED or even less than a high school education, it's not about really having the experience, so long as you're willing to dig in and understand it. And eventually you will understand it if you spend enough time with it, and then you'll be able to see the problems quite quickly.
Well, so the average observer out there, the average government official, upon hearing about your activities, they're going to ask, well, are you saying there's something wrong with our elections of 2020 or maybe of 22? Are you alleging fraud? What are you guys after here?
We've tried to take an attitude that while personally we believe there's fraud, we understand that there's the larger potential for fraud in so many different ways that we want to, in a non-accusatory way, say, this is for all of us, this is a nonpartisan issue, and this is something that we need to do to give the public and the voters the confidence in the election system, because I think right now they don't have that. As time goes on, we believe the fraud is coming to light more and more. But yeah, to answer your question specifically, we do believe there's fraud, but it's wide-ranging and it's not specific to any one methodology. And the certification model that we've proposed kind of covers it all.
Hmm. So I just want to ask, we're going to talk about the legislature here in a second, but I just want to ask, what is it about the system today that makes it more vulnerable to fraud, and specifically what makes it more vulnerable to the certifiers not being able to actually, with a small c, certify the events? I mean, they may sign a paper, but what is it about the system today that prevents them from really seeing what's happening?
Two things. Lack of transparency. So as you said a little bit ago, Lou, it's a black box. Everything goes into the computer system, and people are unable to actually see how the votes are tabulated or which votes are tabulated. And then the second one is, because everything is computerized and you're using large databases for voter rolls, it allows for a very small group of people to be able to cheat on a very large scale without being able to be observed. Whereas years ago, when we were growing up, everything was done by hand and everything was counted by hand, and it's much harder. You just cannot stuff the ballot box with thousands and thousands and thousands of votes because people would see it.
Well, and it's distributed out, too. It used to be like 40 years ago, every precinct counted their own ballots. And so you didn't have all of this complex...
And concentration of technology that allowed you to just, with a few people, can do one mm-hmm. state across the entire state without the county clerks even really understanding it.
Mm-hmm. I know I've been a big proponent of moving back 40 years and re-embracing, re-adopting the counting in the precinct stuff. But I think your approach right now is that, you know, given the current situation, we're going to do everything we can to validate and verify the current process, even though it's done with computers in big voting centers. Isn't that your effort, is to try to tighten that process down so that you eliminate the possibility for fraud?
Precisely.
Okay.
So create additional transparency, bring in third parties who actually have the expertise and the access to the data at each county within our state, and then can do a third-party valid bona fide certification, and then individuals like ourselves actually have access to those same data and can then reduplicate that certification process ourselves and catch the errors of the person certifying the election. It's actually the same process that's used in any number of industries.
Mm-hmm.
You know, certification is, you know, you have somebody who has access to all the data, has the expertise, and is also held accountable if they end up certifying something that turns out to be incorrect and people get hurt, people get killed, or things get stolen.
Yeah. You really want to hold government to that standard, Roy? You're some kind of radical.
Exactly.
I would add to that I think we all would ideally want to go back to paper ballots. But if you even look at an example is the GOP state convention where we proposed with the GOP delegates, to actually do a paper ballot at the convention, we didn't get 30-40% of people to agree to it there.
That and amazed me. That stunned me. Go ahead.
It stunned me as well. And so Roy and I realized even before this happened that people want the technology, even though it's not ideal for transparency. So we need to come up with a system that can verify whatever methodology we use to vote. And that's why we've gone down this route and not the typical route.
We'll have a small debate about that after the show's over.
Okay.
I totally agree with your approach and what you're trying to do. I think I speak for Lowell as well. We want to go back to the paper ballots, and that's just it, and hand counting. But it's a process, and there's many things to do. And you guys have keyed in on something so important that we need to be on right now. So,
well,
here's our premise, essentially,
and that is, if it's unverifiable, it cannot be used. So if we're using the machines and we have our process implemented, we find we can't use machines because they're not verifiable, or the data is not released to us, or for whatever reason, then it will be determined that the machines cannot be used, thus achieving your end goal eventually mm-hmm. of paper ballots.
Awesome.
Sure. But it's just a different way of going about it.
No, absolutely.
Super.
No, similarly, I mean, if you look in history, when we started digging into this, one thing that I learned was at least the first place widespread voter fraud occurred that I'm aware of was Lincoln's second election. And that was the first time that we used mail-in ballots. And the reason we used mail-in ballots is because, you know, a lot of people were fighting and they were on the front line and they couldn't vote in their state. They couldn't go home to vote, so they ended up doing mail-in ballots. But what they ended up finding is that there were a bunch of fake mail-in ballots. And the only reason it was caught is because somebody in New York was looking at the ballots that were coming in, knew the people because it was a relatively small community at the time, and said, hey, this person's dead, this person is, you know, gone, whatever, and then started peeling back the layers of complexity and saw that there was a real problem. Mm-hmm. So even when you have, you know, in-person voting, like what happened with Lyndon Johnson when he won his Democratic primary, he stuffed the ballot box too. And if you have a real valid certification process, if you're doing in-person hand balloting and hand counting, it'll catch that kind of fraud. It'll also catch mail-in ballot fraud. And this process that we're talking about, even if we go back to paper ballots, should stay in place because it needs to be in place, period.
Sure, absolutely. So talking about one place where they seem to be in love with voting machines and don't think a whole lot is wrong. Let's talk for a minute about the state legislature. I mean, we hear that they passed bills for toughen up the elections, election integrity. They're all over it. Talk about that just for a second, guys, if you would.
Yes, in this last session, 2023 legislative session, two bills were passed of significance relative to election integrity, House Bill 269 and House Bill 448. Now, if you read through these bills, they essentially do nothing. they really do nothing. It's just fluff. And I even heard that Deidre Henderson actually wrote House Bill 448 and got a unnamed legislator, senator, to sponsor this bill. He may be from Utah County, he may not be, I don't know. But they essentially do nothing. 269 states that through the Legislative Auditor's Office, biennially, they're going to audit the primary elections as well as the general elections through the state legislator's office, essentially, who is answerable only to the state legislature. It's a bit like the fox watching the hen house, so to speak. It's going to be ineffective. I actually spoke to the gentleman that runs that up there, and I'm not sure that they have the staffing to adequately undertake that. And again, it's not third party, which is critical to the success of a verification system. If you're answerable to one of the entities that's paying you, that's hired you, and essentially you work for, that the system doesn't work. House Bill 269 essentially is fluff. It does nothing. And what was interesting, I want to point out, is as I was reading through these two new pieces of legislation, I came across something very interesting. It was a clause in there that had a remedy for if there was an overvote. And Roy can best explain an overvote, but it's essentially more votes cast than registered voters.
Yes, we've understood Salt Lake County has had a little bit of an issue with that in the past.
As with Utah County as well.
And Davis County. Right. And Davis County also.
Yep.
But so the remedy is at the precinct level, if the pollsters are there counting the votes after the polls close and they find that there are more votes than actual registered voters, the remedy is to get two of the pollsters together, have one of them turn their head, not look, but take out the number of ballots so the two equal each other, the votes cast equal the registered amount. So they're indiscriminately, arbitrarily picking, without looking, votes out. So that, I believe, is a violation of the Constitution, the 14th Amendment, I believe. It's disenfranchising someone's vote, someone's legitimate vote, and it really doesn't solve the problem anyway.
Sounds like you could be subject to human error and inaccuracy, too, just like some other things they claim they don't like.
So the bills, essentially, in our view, are for show purposes only and really do nothing.
So you bring up a great point about the fox and the hen house, right? You've got this legislative auditor's office auditing the election, reporting back to the legislature. Is that what you said?
That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. Right? And so, I mean, if a private company tried to pass off their process, their business process, simply by an internal audit, they'd be laughed out of town because you need a third party, right? You need a third party looking at the thing. So obviously, this is not the right solution. I mean, just to have a legislative auditor's office looking at this doesn't, to me, sound like the right solution.
It's not at all. Again, we need a third-party, independent firm or entity looking at the elections.
Hmm. So tell us a little bit more about your plan. What are you hoping to implement, and how are you going to do it?
Well, the plan is to create a third-party certification process that is transparent and open. And then those people that are conducting the certification and looking into the elections are then held accountable. How we're implementing this plan is first by visiting every county and talking to boards of canvassers and county clerks. Something that I learned as going through this process is, and maybe a lot of other people know this already, but the elections are really conducted at the county level. We have about 3,400 counties in the United States, and 29 of them are here in Utah. And it's the county clerk that actually conducts the election. And then the board of canvassers, which are county councilmen or county councilmen and commissioners, who actually then act as the board of canvassers. What does that mean? What they do is they're supposed to take the results from the county clerk, and then they're supposed to be able to look at those results and say, yes, the election was conducted in accordance with law and accurately reflect the will of the voters, okay? But as Steve was saying before, that group of people don't have the background, don't have the access to the data, typically, and don't have the expertise to actually perform real due diligence on the election at the county level that would be required. And so we go and have the conversation and have exactly the kind of conversations we're having with you now, and solicit their feedback and input. And many of them have been very forthcoming in saying, you know, I really could use the help. Mm-hmm. I want to just do a good job. The county clerks in general just want to do a good job, and they've been very, very, very helpful. A lot of the county commissioners and councilmen say, well, why do I necessarily need your help or outside help? I trust the county clerk because that's my brother-in-law or somebody else like that. And that's not the point. The point is the process itself and the transparency itself, so that it convinces individuals like ourselves to actually conclude that the election was done properly and certified properly. That's the most important thing. And then the next step is to actually get a bill written and put that in front of the state legislature, because ultimately they're the ones that drive this process in the end. But we have to develop the structure of this certification process from the ground up, because those are the people at the front line, the board of canvassers and the county clerks.
Well, I think that's both audacious and wonderful that you're visiting with all of the counties, you know, here in Utah. I assume it's just within Utah at this point.
It's just in Utah.
And so, and I sense in your answer that the county clerks, for the most part, have been very willing and cooperative and interested in the help that you might provide, the suggestions and so forth, but that the county commissioners, maybe not so much?
I'd say it's even.
Pretty
even, I would
even,
say
good.
It's even between the county clerks and the county commissioners. There's a lot of skepticism, but after we get into the discussion, you can usually see that skepticism go away, largely because of the way we're approaching it, which is we're equating it to other certification processes that we're all familiar with outside of elections. That's part one. And part two, we're not going into it saying, you know, look, there's fraud everywhere and you're the problem, because otherwise people get defensive. And that's not the point. I don't think that these people are genuinely trying to do the best job possible. And so once they see we're trying to do the best job possible, it becomes a problem solving session rather than a
cool
another kind of session.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic. And I'm particularly interested in the response that you've received in the biggest, most populous counties of the state, right? I'm talking Salt Lake County, Utah County, Weber County. What can you give me some sense of have they embraced you? Have they put you off? I mean, what's been the response there?
Actually, the larger counties, I think, I think Roy would agree with this, have been the most receptive.
Oh, good.
Starting with Lanny Chapman up in Salt Lake, this is where it really started. Just to give a little history, I was the only person that went and watched the audit for Salt Lake County election last year, 2022. The only person out of
That's
what,
unbelievable.
1 point, yeah, it really is. I was shocked. I was there from start to finish. One council member showed up, and that was it. And he was very he was put out that I was there.
Well, people didn't even know that they could go watch, right? I mean, how did you find out you could go watch?
Actually, I was asked to go by Goud.
Okay.
That's why I went. And it
was. And Goud is?
Goud ran for Salt Lake County clerk.
So you're kind of a poll watcher for him then?
Well, he just asked me to go.
Go watch.
Yeah, I mean, he's a friend of mine, and I helped with his campaign. He helped with mine, and so on and so forth. But through that process, one county council member showed up, just one out of nine. And I was shocked at that. And even he was put out that I was there. He acted like I had no right to be there. He ended up cussing me out and storming out of the room. Well, when they went to certify a few days later, several of us showed up and we had a series of questions that we wanted to ask the Board of Canvassers. And they simply could not answer these questions. And that kicked off what was a letter writing or an email writing campaign to get to the bottom of the answers that we had been asking, which are, you know, essentially, how did you come to the conclusion? Why did you not show up to the audit? All sorts of questions that they refused to answer or couldn't answer. And this led to an email writing campaign. And I'm trying to get to your answer, but just to give a little background, we were put off, and I wrote and wrote and wrote and time again, and finally, some answers started to trickle in because of persistence, and this led to a meeting with Roy and I and Lanny Chapman initially. I think she was one of our first, wasn't she?
Mm-hmm. And she is.
And she's the Salt Lake County. The new Salt Lake County clerk, as she was an underling of Sherry Swenson, mm-hmm. had been in the office for several years. And she actually received this very, very well. And for those that don't know, she's a Democrat. Salt Lake, in large part, is democratically held. But she received it quite well. We ended up meeting with her on several occasions. She started initiating conversations with Ricky Hatch of Weber County, and the idea was that they would come back with responses and ideas to our basic premise, mm-hmm. which is based on the Sarbanes-Oxley model that we'll get into in a minute. But she was very willing to help and genuinely seemed like she wanted to help get to the bottom of it. She was interested in transparency as well. I don't think they're just words. I think that she was sincere in that.
Sure.
Moving to Utah County, we met with Aaron Davidson, who was the Utah County clerk, who I believe ran on the issue, mm-hmm. if I'm correct.
Yep. Yeah,
and, of course, he was very, very receptive, willing to help in anything that we do, believes in what we're doing, but understands the difficulty that it will be in getting it implemented. And so the larger counties have been very receptive. It's actually been the smaller counties that say, hey, you know, leave us alone. We don't have fraud in our counties. It's all up in the big counties. We do it all right here. And it's been hard to get in the door with them. But as Roy said, once we do, they're very receptive to our ideas.
That's counterintuitive to me. I mean, I understand, you know, Aaron did run on an election integrity platform, which in itself is unique. But I'm very encouraged, aren't you, Lowell, that they're having a conversation in Salt Lake County, which is, gosh, a third of the state, maybe?
Yeah, the most populous county in the state. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
We agree with you. We are... the timing now is that we would follow up with her, but due to the 2nd Congressional District, she's got an upcoming election that's mm-hmm. kind of put her on hold with us for now. Mm-hmm. But we will continue that dialogue, and I think she's going to hold a lot of weight in this. And like we said at the outset, this is a nonpartisan issue. We believe that every American, every voter, every citizen truly wants transparency. It's just that we think many of them are deceived.
Sure. So The term Sarbanes-Oxley has already been mentioned. I'm guessing not a large number of our radio audience or video audience is going to be familiar with that. So tell us a little bit about what Sarbanes-Oxley is and why in the world can we apply it to our elections here in the state of Utah?
Sure. Sarbanes-Oxley was a law that was adopted as a result of a bunch of accounting scandals, including Enron. Many listeners probably remember the name Enron and the fraud that occurred, and that was around in the early 2000s, and the law was actually passed. The names of the two politicians are Sarbanes and Oxley, and it was passed in 2002. And what was happening leading up to the accounting scandals, like at Enron, WorldCom, Adelphia, was the accounting firms that were both auditing and certifying the financial statements of these big public companies were getting too intertwined with their clients. In other words, they were getting a lot of business, not just the accounting business, but other type of businesses like a tax business and other things. And the executives in some of these companies were saying, hey, look, you have to go with the reporting and kind of creative accounting reporting, and it made the accounting statements very difficult to read, which then allowed corrupt executives like the people at Enron to actually manipulate their earnings and commit real fraud. So what Sarbanes-Oxley did was say, hey, look, these accounting firms, if you're either doing audit functions and certification of financial statement functions, then that's what you do. That's the only thing that you can do. You can't do everything else. And in addition, the individuals at the accounting firm and the individuals at the company, the executives like the CEO and CFO, when you sign your name on these accounting statements, the public statements, if there's something that's materially wrong and you should have known, you're the accountant at Arthur Andersen, for example, we can come after you as an individual, not your firm, you as an individual, and put civil penalties on you that can bankrupt you so they can be held accountable. And what that did was it created an atmosphere where nobody was going to try and do something wrong for fear of putting their own livelihoods in jeopardy. So that created this tension, which is, so now how does that apply to elections? Well, if you think about it, we just talked about the legislative auditor. We also talked about how Steve went and looked at the audit or the certification process that the Board of Canvassers in Salt Lake did. Right now, what you have is the election equipment manufacturers perform audits, so they're auditing themselves. You've got the county clerks performing audits, they're auditing their own performance. And then you've got the county, the Board of Canvassers, and they're certifying results without really even having access to the data. And nobody can be held accountable. So you have no access to data, no access to, there's no way of holding individuals accountable for certifying an erroneous result. And so applying Sarbanes-Oxley is really saying, hey, look, what worked in that world, and it works spectacularly well, can be applied here by saying, look, we get a third party who can certify, who has the expertise and the access to the data, and we hold all of these people accountable if they're not doing their jobs. And that's exactly the same application. And that's it. That's why, since it works so well, why not apply it here?
That is an awesome idea. Folks, you're listening to KTalk Media, KBJA 1640 AM. This is The Path to State and Local Sovereignty. I'm your host, Lowell Nelson. And with me in studio today, of course, is Lou Moore, Roy Piscadlo, who just explained Sarbanes-Oxley to us, and Steve Aist, who has been interviewing and visiting with many of our county commissioners, county clerks, and so forth across the state. So so back to you, Roy. After explaining Sarbanes-Oxley, the idea to the Board of Canvassers
and
the county clerks that you've been with whom you've been visiting, how have they received this idea, and are they willing to, put themselves under the microscope, so to speak, of a third party?
Generally, yes. Mm-hmm. They raise two primary issues.
Okay.
Okay. First issue is, okay, you're going to hire a firm that has the expertise that is going to put people in all 29 counties to collect this data and then to perform a certification at a report for the board of canvassers in each county. Who's going to pay for that?
Good question.
Okay. And the answer is the state has to pay for it. Okay. And they said, good luck. And that's the biggest one. So that's the biggest hurdle, okay, from their perspective. The second one is they say, look, you're asking for data that we can't get. So, for example, many people may know, I know that you guys know, that there's three categories of, and this is just one example among many, three categories of registered voters. You have withheld, private, and public. It's very difficult for individuals to get access to the withheld database, the withheld voter database. Mm-hmm. Okay, so how we have to actually get the law changed to allow that. And when people try and get withheld voters or cast vote records or access to the machines, we're told no because we're told no. And so we have to get, and so they're saying, how can you get that? I said, well, we're going to have to get that changed.
Money and access. Interesting.
Right, and those are the two. Those are the two big complaints. But other than that, they say, if you can make that work, I'm in.
Cool. Well, I'm happy to hear that. And so how are we going to make that work? That's the next question, right? How do we do that?
Well, we've been to 22 of the 29 counties thus far. Mm-hmm. We've had some difficulty getting to the remaining seven, but we'll be persistent and we'll do that. The reason that we've gone to the county clerks and Board of Canvas members, obviously, is because they're at ground level. As we go and meet with legislators, they want to know what the county clerks think, mainly the county clerks, more so than the Board of Canvassers, because county clerks are the ones that actually perform the election. Mm. So the number of legislators so far that we've spoken to want to know what the feedback is from these county clerks and Board of Canvas members. So we intend on meeting with each and every legislator, both senators and House reps, individually or collectively, if that's the case, to have this similar discussion with them. And we can be quite convincing, and it makes sense. If you look at it at face value, it just makes sense. And the question I would ask is, why wouldn't you do it? Mm-hmm. This makes sense. It would give voters confidence in the process, again, which they've lost, clearly. And we need to really examine and get back to free and fair elections in this country. And so the next step is go to more and more legislators. I'm hopeful that we can get, Roy has done essentially a term sheet that we need to turn into draft legislation, mm-hmm. and turn it over to a legislator that we select. You know, people say, well, who's willing to do this? And we don't look at it like that. It's who are we willing to let do it? Because mm-hmm. it's so important that the basic principles of this are not changed. They are not compromised up on the Hill in committee or whatever the case may be. Because once you take out one element of the Sarbanes-Oxley model, it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And so we have to find someone that has real backbone. And ideally, it would be co-sponsored by Republicans and Democrats, mm-hmm. because it is a nonpartisan issue. And we would like to think that everyone has a vested interest in truth and transparency.
Given your current trajectory, do you see this legislation being considered in the upcoming 24 session?
We're hopeful, but it's realistically, it just may not happen. And the reason is because it's hard to get these meetings. It's really mm-hmm. hard to get people to commit to sit down with us. And you start adding up the numbers, it's hundreds of people. So.
Well, I can help. I know my rep and my senator be happy to sit down with you. So And there's probably a lot of people around this state that would be have similar interests in arranging those meetings for you.
And that's where, you know, the public comes into play, because that's been a key component in actually getting meetings with Board of Canvas members and clerks, is local people arranging those meetings for us, because we don't know them, but the local people do.
Yeah.
So we would ask those people to reach out to us, and if, you know, if we may, we can provide our email addresses to you before we leave the show, and they can jot that down and reach out to us.
Well, you're welcome to give us your, I mean, if you like, right now on the air, emails and or telephone numbers.
Yeah, well, at minimum, we need to direct them to electioncertificationmatters.com to learn more about all the things they're doing. And there is our way on the website that they can communicate with you? That might be the best way to do it.
Yeah, there's a comment section there where they can leave their information. But I'd also like to leave my email address.
Okay.
It's AST, that's A-S-T-E, the number 4, Utah, at gmail.com.
A-S-T-E, the digit 4, Utah, at gmail.com, right?
Correct.
Excellent. Okay.
We're running out of time, but there's been a lot of news lately about election fraud, of all things. Can you believe that? The most perfect election in the history of the United States. But now some people are saying not so much, a lot more people even than were after 2020. And without, you know, there's the Michigan case. There is still so many questions in Georgia, where the president now is in the crosshairs. There are questions in Wisconsin, the Gableman report. I mean, we can go on, and we don't have the time to do it. But is this climate where there are so many new news stories, as well as the old ones, affecting your conversations with any of these elected officials?
Short answer is not so much.
Okay.
Okay.
This is Utah, after all.
No, it's yes, but it's also the audience. There are some within that do understand that the general public is skeptical of the elections, and they even tell us stories of constituents coming into the county building and threatening county clerks, physically threatening and acting menacingly. And so they realize that there is a problem, and it is creating an enormous amount of pressure on hiring and retaining county clerks, because actually conducting an election is one small part of their job, and yet it is an enormous amount of the work and heartburn that they face as professionals working for the county.
Sure.
Okay. And so.
And we should make it clear, we're not into that.
No.
By any.
No,
means.
Not by any. So we feel bad for them. That's the one thing that, as we met everybody, we go, man, what a hard job, and it's hard. Mm-hmm. So this certification process, actually, we think can help take a lot of the pressure off of those professionals, the county clerks, and help the counties retain people for those jobs. Hmm.
Boy, that would be great. Very, very welcome. I'm sure that they would welcome that. And so this certification process then sounds to me like will become statute in Utah code. Is that
That's
goal?
Where it has to be.
Yeah,
that's
okay.
Where it has to be. And a lot of the feedback from different county commissioners and council members in counties like Box Elder and so on, mm-hmm. have come up with ideas on where it should go and how it should be structured to make sure, for example, that once the state says, okay, we'll pay for it, then it doesn't become an obligation of the counties, and then they say, we were just kidding, you pay for it. So, you know, it's those types of little things that are really critically important. Going back to what Steve was saying, we have to make sure that these components stay in there, otherwise you just destroy the utility of something like Sarbanes-Oxley.
Sure.
Well, we have only about 1 minute left. I want to give you an opportunity to give any final words or encouragement or have inspiration here in this effort. Go ahead, Steve.
Okay, there's something that I came across in the state constitution. It's also, by the way, in the federal constitution. in the state constitution, it's Article 1, Section 27, under fundamental rights. And it says, frequent recurrence to fundamental principles is essential to the security of the individual right to the perpetuity of a free government. Mm. And to me, that says, we need to stop. We need to look at what we're doing. We need to go back to what the original intent of these laws were. And we need to start over and reset.
Mm. So absolutely. Amen to that.
Yes. Go ahead, Roy. Any last thoughts?
We could really use the help of all the listeners. And we encourage your involvement. If you can go to our website and contact us, send Steve an email. And if we come to your county, talk to your county commissioners, and if you can help us arrange meetings with your state house reps and your state senators, we would love to participate. Have you participate in that meeting with us? And because it's very, very difficult to get all these meetings and coordinate all this. And many times they look at us and go, "You're in Salt Lake County. We don't need to talk to you." But if it's a local person, they do. And it's a great conversation. We enjoy actually going and meeting all these people across the state. It's a lot of driving, but it's fun.
And your website is electioncertificationmatters.com.
And I will just add, don't forget to go to securevote.news to learn more about news all over the country. Sign our petition to change the entire election system. Someday it has to happen, but my hat is off to both of you gentlemen. You are paving the way of doing it. As Steve Bannon says, action, action, action. And thank you for your efforts.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
You're welcome. So good to have you. Ladies and gentlemen, this has been the show this morning, Path to State and Local Sovereignty. Hope you've enjoyed it. We'll be posted on soundcloud.com/ktalkmedia. And we'd encourage you to go there, visit that site. And if you'll do that, well, I'll be back again here next week, next Tuesday morning at 9 o'clock for another show here on the Path to State and Local Sovereignty. Please stay tuned for John's show. Talk with John up next from 10 to 12 here on KTalk Media, KBJA 1640 AM.
Officers who were indicted must surrender at the Fulton County Jail in Atlanta by noon on Friday. Greg Clugston,
was brought
Washington.
To my attention
also
at townhall.com,
Tropical Storm Hillary has lost much of its force, but there's still a threat of locally catastrophic flooding across much of southeastern Oregon into the west central mountains of Idaho.
And I'm trying to
potential
pull
thunderstorms
up,
and localized torrential rains. National Hurricane Center specialist Philippe Pepin says Tropical Storm Harold hitting Texas today will bring significant
rain. The
FBI
raided the home of Craig Robertson in Provo.
And it's located about 70 miles just outside.